Roger. Go and throttle up.
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded.
At 7 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time, air and naval forces of the United States launched a series of strikes against Muammar Gaddafi's subversive activities.
Task News Agency says one of the four reactors at the Chernobyl atomic power plant was damaged.
There's plane all over the place. People's yards, some of it's on the freeway, some of it's all over the streets.
I am Salvador H. Laurel. Are taking power in the name and by the will of the Filipino people.
The United States extends recognition to this new government, headed by President Aquino.
We want the truth. The president wants it. I want it. And the American people have a fundamental right to it.
We are the keepers of the flame of liberty, the beacon of hope, a light under the nations.
From the UPI Radio Network, this is 1986, the year in review, and I'm Dennis Daly. 1986 was the year of Challenger and the year of Chernobyl, the year a gentle revolution brought change to the Philippines, and the year one of this country's most popular presidents became embroiled in an international scandal. Our story begins at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and UPI Radio Network correspondent Rob Nabius.
1986 was to have been NASA's greatest year, 15 shuttle missions, as well as historic unmanned interplanetary and astronomical exploration. But the year began with a cloud hanging over NASA, its administrator under indictment for defrauding the government while an executive in the private sector, and with Columbia requiring 7 attempts to be launched and 3 attempts to land in the year's first shuttle flight. But the clouds lifted to reveal crystal cold skies on January 28th, as 7 astronauts boarded Challenger, including schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe, for a mission to once again galvanize the nation to manned spaceflight. What occurred instead burned horror into the psyche of the American people.
Engines throttling up, 3 engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Flight photo.
Go ahead.
RSO reports vehicle exploded.
Copy. We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
I regret that I have to report that based on very preliminary searches of the ocean where the Challenger impacted this morning, these searches have not revealed any evidence that the crew of Challenger survived.
It was the worst disaster in the history of manned spaceflight and plunged the nation into mourning. The shock soon turned to anger as a presidential commission assigned to investigate the catastrophe uncovered a decade of mismanagement in the development of the shuttle's solid rocket boosters, which ruptured during Challenger's climb to orbit, destroying the spacecraft. Top NASA officials were unaware, it was revealed, of a stormy conference between the manufacturers of the boosters, Morton Thiokol, and NASA booster rocket engineers the night before the disaster.
This was a meeting where the determination was to launch, and it was up to us to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was not safe to do so.
At year's end, astronauts climbed back into a shuttle to practice countdowns, but said the agony of 1986 simply would not go away.
I think it's going to be very difficult to look at an orbiter or look at the launch pad without having those kind of flashbacks. They were our friends, they were our companions, they were our very close friends, and I don't think I'm ever going to quite get over that completely.
Liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Control program.
Roger, roll, Challenger.
Dick, Mike, Judy, L, Ron, Greg, and Krista, your families and your country mourn your passing. We bid you goodbye. We will never forget you.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Rob Nabius at the Kennedy Space Center.
1986, the year in review, continues in a moment on the UPI Radio Network.
If you've been listening to UPI Roundtable, you've heard Nancy Reagan talk about life with her husband.
He doesn't bring it home with him. You know that he's upset, but he doesn't. He's one of a kind.
You've heard a former anorexic talk about living with an eating disorder.
I remember being in the hospitals and ripping an IV out of my arm because it had too many calories. I couldn't eat a full piece of toast at a time because that just seemed like a full meal. It would take me about 2 hours if I was going to eat an apple.
You've heard Postal Union Chief Mo Biller respond to the government's latest contract offer.
Garbage in capital letters. G-A-R-B-A-G-E.
Hi, I'm Vicki Barker. If you've been listening to UPI Roundtable, you know that each week we bring you the people you want to hear and the information you need to know, be it medicine, politics, or showbiz. It's all here on UPI Roundtable. If you don't know that, well, maybe you should start listening.
During much of 1986, President Reagan enjoyed one of the highest approval ratings of any American president. But as UPI Radio White House correspondent Bill Small reports, one day, late in the year, that all began to change.
On November 13th, Ronald Reagan made a statement that would change the way America looked at his presidency.
I authorized the transfer of small amounts of defensive weapons and spare parts for defensive systems to Iran.
Mr. Reagan said he did it to woo what he called moderates in the Iranian government, as well as to help free American hostages in Lebanon. But controversy turned into scandal just 12 days later.
I was not fully informed on the nature of one of the activities undertaken in connection with this initiative. This action raises serious questions of propriety.
The Attorney General said it appeared that part of the proceeds from arms sold to Iran were skimmed off and sent to Nicaraguan Contras. National Security Advisor John Poindexter resigned. His deputy, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, was fired. As the scandal spread, Attorney General Meese asked the courts for an independent counsel. Congress decided that special select committees in the House and Senate would conduct their own investigations. Mr. Reagan's approval rating dropped 20 points. And an opinion poll showed nearly half of those responding believed that Mr. Reagan was lying. I'm Bill Small at the White House.
North and Poindexter continued to take the Fifth Amendment, though Vice President Bush, in an Iowa speech okayed by the White House, pushed for both to open up as a Christmas present to the nation.
The country cannot wait any longer. Both Admiral Poindexter and Colonel North should now step forward and tell us the whole truth.
The situation was further complicated by the arrests of two U.S. citizens in Nicaragua. One caught when a plane full of supplies bound for the Contras was shot down, and the second arrested while on an admitted mission for a spy-for-hire company. The downed flyer, Eugene Hassenfuss, was sentenced first to 30 years, then given a pardon. The other, the brother of an Ohio congressman, is still being held. America flexed its military muscles on April 14 to strike at Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. The president took to the airwaves to explain why our fighters had bombed Libyan targets. President Reagan said he had warned Gaddafi earlier in the year that any further Libyan-sponsored acts of terrorism would meet with swift reprisals. Then, on April 5th, a U.S. GI was among two people killed when a bomb went off in a restaurant in West Berlin.
Today, we have done what we had to do. If necessary, we shall do it again.
Two U.S. airmen did not return from the mission. Their plane went down in the Mediterranean off the coast of Libya. The international chess game of U.S.-Soviet relations reached a new stalemate with the arrest of a U.S. journalist, Nicholas Daniloff, the Moscow bureau chief for U.S. News and World Report. The arrest came just days after a Soviet citizen, Gennady Zakharov, had been arrested in New York on spy charges. There was instant talk of a swap, but Secretary of State George Shultz was adamant in his assertion that the cases were not similar.
Zakharov was caught spying. He is a spy, and we have the evidence. Now, as far as Mr. Daniloff is concerned, he is not a spy. He was set up.
2 weeks later, Daniloff was allowed to leave Soviet custody and go to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Then, a month after the original arrests, Daniloff unexpectedly headed for the Moscow airport.
12 o'clock Central Time, a Lufthansa Airlines liner left Moscow, bound for Frankfurt, West Germany, and on board are Mr. and Mrs. Nicholas Daniloff.
The next day, Zakharov pleaded no contest to spy charges in a New York City court, and soon he too was headed home. A prominent Soviet dissident, Yuri Orlov, was released to go to the West as part of a complicated exchange. President Reagan insisted that the Orlov release was linked to the Zakharov release, and that Danilov was merely let go by the Soviets. No strings attached.
Unfortunately, this case will have a very intimidating effect on my colleagues, because what happened to me could be happened to anybody.
The Danilov release preceded a hastily called summit meeting. It was held in the Icelandic capital of Reykjavik. It was a weekend of high hopes, and there it ended. Like so many chess championships held in Reykjavik before, confrontation and stalemate in the ongoing game of East-West diplomacy. At first, a few Scandinavian nations thought their own nuclear facilities might be leaking radiation. But soon it became apparent the skies of northwestern Europe were becoming saturated with radiation from the world's worst nuclear power plant accident. UPI's Luther Whittington relayed the first confirmation from the Soviet government.
Soviet TV said aid is being given to those affected. The Soviet media only reports disasters when they affect foreigners or large numbers of Soviets.
The Soviets were slow to give details. Vice President George Bush told newsmen the U.S. government was annoyed.
There's been some response that I can't go into the detail, but it really isn't near enough, and it's sparse at best.
It may take a century for the reactor to cool. On May 25th, millions of Americans in big cities, small towns, and rural areas alike linked hands in what was one of the most ambitious projects in the history of the world. Here are some echoes of Hands Across America.
Everybody hold hands. Balloons by the hundreds are being released here. Just a few minutes ago, we had a fireboat shooting streams of water in New York Harbor.
They're holding hands out here in Long Beach. There are thousands of people running right out to the end of the dock where the Queen Mary is. They're all holding hands at the very end of the line, a family from a local shelter.
President Reagan, Mrs. Reagan, holding hands with some children.
The project was a success in raising money to help starving Americans, but it fell short of its announced financial goal. 1986, the year in review, continues in a moment on the UPI Radio Network.
News first, fast, accurate, and up to the minute. That's what you can expect on this UPI Radio Network station.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
The vehicle apparently has exploded. We will keep you updated here on the UPI Radio Network just as soon as any further developments occur.
During the course of the attack on Tripoli and one other Libyan city, watching the entire affair was UPI correspondent Marie Colvin.
We heard bombs falling. I was in the consul of the British representative in Tripoli.
Live from UPI Radio on Governor's Island in New York Harbor, America salutes liberty.
The light growing, slowly in intensity, picking out on the statue the book that Liberty cradles in her arm.
UPI Radio correspondents are there around the nation, around the world, around the clock, bringing you developments as they happen. Keep it tuned to this UPI Radio Network station.
Americans watched democracy being reborn in a country halfway around the world in 1986, and UPI Radio's Bob Fuss was there.
It was a year for chanting Cory Aquino's name and wearing yellow in the Philippines, an extraordinary year that saw the downfall of a dictator by an almost gentle revolution and a new government that at year's end still teetered on the edge of survival. As 1986 began, Ferdinand Marcos faced a February election challenge from Cory Aquino, the widow of a martyred opposition leader. The election attracted worldwide attention. Aquino attracted immense crowds.
If you insist in using violence, then violence it is, and we will show you that we can handle anything that you can do.
As voting began, it became clear Marcos did not intend to lose. Cheating was widespread, cash paid for votes, ballot boxes stuffed, poll watchers murdered. In places, nuns draped their bodies over ballot boxes to protect them. Marcos finally had himself declared the winner. Aquino led demonstrations. 2 weeks later, a dramatic turn as Marcos' longtime defense minister Juan Ponce Enrile and Chief of Staff General Fidel Ramos launched a rebellion with a handful of troops. Soon, hundreds of thousands of unarmed civilians surrounded the camp where they held up.
A military helicopter
flying into Camp Crommy, presumably carrying more defectors from the military forces who were joining Lieutenant General Ramos here in his opposition to President Marcos. Thousands of people out at the front gates here. Many are throwing bread and sending other food in to the soldiers.
As his support evaporated, Marcos was sworn in for another term on the same day Aquino also took the oath.
I and Salvador H. Langrell are taking power in the name and by the will of the Filipino people.
That night, Marcos, his military abandoning him and his palace surrounded, was evacuated by an American helicopter and ended up in exile in Hawaii, fighting off legal battles aimed at recovering billions of dollars he had taken with him. In Manila, there was celebration.
Through the power of the people, we are home again.
Somebody.
But the Aquino and Reilly alliance was shaky, and at year's end, General Ramos stepped in to stop a planned coup against Aquino, and Reilly was ousted. A ceasefire was signed with the communists. The fragile democracy created by people's power was by no means guaranteed, but it had survived a tumultuous year. This is Bob Fox.
The ongoing tragedy of Americans being held hostage in Lebanon continued this year, but two were released. Father Lawrence Jenko and the administrator of the American University Hospital in Beirut, David Jacobson. Jenko was released first. He brought with him a tape of Jacobson, still held hostage, pleading for help in obtaining his release.
There are days when I believe that the government really doesn't care about me and that we have been totally abandoned.
Throughout the year, Anglican Church envoy Terry Waite continued to work for the release of all hostages. Some, though, viewed Waite as a headline seeker.
That's the sort of crossfire I have to put up with. And if it's said, it's said. And if I can't take it, then I should get out of it.
Nearly a dozen U.S. and French hostages remain in captivity. Death rained from the skies over suburban Los Angeles in late August. An Aeromexico DC-9 on a landing approach to L.A. International Airport was struck by a light plane. The DC-9 slammed nearly upside down into a residential neighborhood.
I was sitting on my front yard, and I looked up, and I saw this plane coming down, and it was spinning around real slow. And then I thought I was dead for sure. It was pretty scary.
UPI Radio's Bob Brill went to the scene to describe what happened.
There is just parts of bodies all over the place. The bodies being covered up, of course, with the yellow bags. Which the authorities always do at any scene where there is death. There are parts of personal effects such as handbags, luggage all over the place, a baby shoe, things like that. It certainly is one very, very messy scene.
More than 85 died in the accident, 3 in the small plane, 14 on the ground, and the others in the DC-9. The incident became a focal point for a re-examination of air safety. That same August 31st, 400 people died when a Soviet cruise liner collided with a cargo ship in the Black Sea.
Today, I received with regret Chief Justice Berger's letter formally notifying me of his retirement.
The highest court in the land got a change of face in 1986 when Chief Justice Warren Berger resigned to have more time to organize a celebration for the U.S. Constitution's bicentennial. The president promoted William Rehnquist to be Chief Justice and filled out the court with a Washington, D.C. federal judge named Antonin Scalia. For Scalia, the son of an immigrant family, it was an unexpected honor.
Getting nominated to the Supreme Court is the culmination of a dream, of course, and I'm greatly honored that the president would have such confidence in me and hope that the Senate will do so as well, and I'll certainly do whatever I can to live up to it.
Scalia was confirmed unanimously. Though some senators said Rehnquist was too extreme to be Chief Justice, he too was confirmed. This means the conservative majority of the court is now a lot younger. And with justices appointed for life, a conservative Supreme Court may turn out to be Ronald Reagan's most enduring legacy. This was the year that rock superstar Bruce Springsteen finally pleased his fans by releasing a set of live concert recordings spanning a 10-year period.
The five-record set became number one on the charts the first week it was offered for sale, unprecedented in the music industry. Fans of The Boss waited in line all night to be the first to own a set. This was also the year President Reagan told voters to vote for him one last time. Here are some echoes of Election 86.
If you'd like to vote for me one more time, you can do so by voting for Jim Santini.
This is not a referendum on the president. These elections were decided on their own individual characteristics, on issues, the personalities that were relevant to that particular state.
We can work well with the Democrats. It's going to make it more difficult, though, for Ronald Reagan.
I would have to say he's going to have a hard time in the future getting the money for the Contras.
How sweet it is.
For Democrats, it was a sweet victory. They regained control of the Senate, and with a bigger margin than the Republicans had enjoyed. Republicans, though, did well in many state and local offices. 1986, the year in review, continues in a moment on the UPI Radio Network.
Hi, this is Andy Polin, inviting you to join me here on many of these UPI stations for football analysis. You'll hear from the players.
A lot sort of puts us in front of the firing squad with the head guy saying aim.
The coaches.
Not a miracle worker. I'm not a genius. Don't lay any belief in the fact that we are going to be successful because I'm here.
The fans.
Oh, the Dallas Cowboys going to win the Super Bowl.
Miami.
I think the Redskins going to win.
I think it's those black jerseys, that dark color scares the other guy.
Because they are good.
And the great moment.
California has won it. This is the most incredible finish I have ever seen in a football game.
Football analysis. It's fun. It's exciting. And it lets you know what's going on. College football and the pros. Join us right here, won't you?
Organist pulled out all the stops, and so did the British Isles in July for the royal wedding of Commoner Sarah Ferguson to formerly eligible bachelor Prince Andrew.
To have and to hold.
To have and to hold.
From this day forward.
From this day forward.
And the Archbishop of Canterbury made it all official.
Those whom God hath joined together, let no man put asunder.
The week before, the U.S. had had its own royal wedding of sorts when Caroline Kennedy tied the knot. And there was a not-so-royal wedding when actress Zsa Zsa Gabor got married again, this time to a prince whose title is in dispute. We lost some longtime friends in 1986, actor Jimmy Cagney, and later in the year, actor Keenan Wynn and the ever-debonair Cary Grant. Desi Arnaz died, Donna Reed, composer Alan J. Lerner, and the Duchess of Windsor. A king had given up his throne for her. U.S. Senator John East committed suicide. Insurance salesman and Little League coach Bill Schrader died. We had known him as Bionic Bill and watched him live for nearly 2 years on an artificial heart. Paul Frees died. You may not recognize the name, but you've heard his voice a million times.
Don't forget home baked at your house.
Yes, this is Boris Bedenov speaking. Ha, 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 ha.
And America's elder statesman Averell Harriman died at age 94.
When the moon comes over the mountain.
Kate Smith died. Once a president had said, Kate Smith is America. Her stirring rendition of God Bless America rallied a country in wartime. And her death came less than a month before one of the nation's greatest patriotic celebrations, the relighting of Lady Liberty's torch. The event, spearheaded by Chrysler President Lee Iacocca, had begun with the ringing of New York City's church bells.
Let's make freedom ring throughout this land.
We leave you with some echoes of Liberty Weekend 1986.
But there are still 3 days to go.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. To be a part of this special event makes you feel like a very small grain of sand because it's such a great big thing and the whole idea is so huge and the whole significance of it is so great.
We are the keepers of the flame of liberty. We hold it high tonight for the world to see, a beacon of hope, a light unto the nations.
1986, the year in review, has been a presentation of the UPI Radio Network. Dennis Daly speaking. This is the UPI Radio Network.